I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. While the U.S. economy has been expanding and creating new jobs, the public is still anxious, even gloomy, about work, including pay and security. We'll be talking about a new survey by Rutgers University that explores why so many people are feeling so bad about the economy 5 years after the recession was declared over. Contradicting all that is a new report from the Conference Board that found that consumer confidence was at a seven-year high. The U.S. economy grew by a healthy 4.2% between April and the end of June. So what explains this mismatch? We asked Neil Irwin to get our conversation started. He's senior economics correspondent at the New York Times, The Upshot, wrote a book called The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Neil Irwin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So what do you think explains this mismatch?
I think it's fairly straightforward. We've had steady growth for the last 5 years since the recession ended, but that growth has not accrued to wages and salaries for ordinary people. So we've seen quite strong wage growth among very high-end professions, among the wealthy. We haven't seen the kind of broad-based middle-class income growth that you might like to see. One measure I wrote about just last week is median income numbers are still below their 2009 level when you adjust for inflation. So if you see growth, you see the unemployment rate falling, that's all good news, but that's not really making your life better if you haven't seen a raise in 5 years.
In fact, as you wrote, the median household income today is $53,891, down, I guess, a couple of $1,000 from pre-recession levels?
Right, and that's the dominant story of not just the last 5 years, but the last 15 years or so. Median incomes haven't reached back to their level of 2000 or 1999, and that's a sign that the growth we've had this last 15 years is not showing up in the pocketbooks of ordinary working Americans, and that's one of the dominant reasons that people are pretty miserable and not happy with the economy at all, despite the overall growth and the falling unemployment rate.
So why hasn't it shown up in the pockets?
Well, this is an interesting set of debates, and there's a number of explanations and a number of possible reasons. You can weight them according to your own views. One is global trade, so there's more imports coming in from elsewhere, and a lot of the jobs making that stuff were those kind of middle class jobs that paid well. There's the decline of union membership. Unions were a force for kind of extracting more of the nation's product and more of that wealth toward working Americans. They're less powerful now. There's technology. So technology has evolved in a way that replaces a lot of those kind of middle-class jobs that used to keep people busy, whether it's factory work, whether it's, even in an office. You see very few people doing kind of rote tasks these days. And technology has favored people with very advanced educations and the very low end, like fast food work, and not the middle class. So all those are likely factors.
Would it be fair to say, though, that economists view the economy or perhaps even use different measures when deciding the health of the economy or not compared to the public?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's if you're an ordinary person, if you're just trying to go about your life and have a decent job and a decent income, what you care about is what's in front of you. Can you afford a decent standard of living for your family? Can you afford a decent place to live and feed yourself comfortably? That's the measure of how the economy is doing for most people. Economists tend to look at aggregates. So if you're Janet Yellen at the Federal Reserve or somebody trying to make policy for the entire country, you worry about what's GDP growth, what's the unemployment rate, and those are kind of different things than what's happening at that ground level of how people are able to live their lives.
And literally live the economy.
It is. Again, it doesn't matter if GDP has risen 10% if your income is stagnant, and that's what we've had the last several years. An environment where, even during this last couple of years when growth has been a little stronger, wage growth has been right around 2%, which is about what inflation has been. So if your income only rises, 2% and prices also rise 2%, you're not actually any better off. And that's the story of this recovery so far.
You mentioned Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve Chairwoman, and she has not at least yet raised interest rates. Do you think she's telling us something about the economy or about jobs?
Yeah, I think what we've heard from her in a number of situations, including in a speech out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, just a couple weeks ago, is that she still sees a lot of weakness in this labor market, in this job market, and she wants for the Federal Reserve to keep its pedal on the gas to try and get this economy revving, get this job market revving. She even mentioned wages, as we've been talking about. and tried and mentioned the need to ensure that wages are growing before the Fed gets serious about tightening monetary policy, raising interest rates, trying to slow things down. So I think that the message out of Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve is we see some of these problems and we want to encourage this recovery to be felt more broadly before we really pull the punch bowl away.
But has that worked? I know there's a lot of money sloshing around the economy, but has it worked so that people who are on the sort of harder edges of the economy are feeling it?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great challenges of the last few years. I think what we've had, not just in the U.S., actually, but also in Europe and in Britain and Japan, is the central banks have been doing a lot of the heavy lifting of trying to encourage economic growth. But the tools they have are very limited. So what the Federal Reserve's been doing is buying trillions of dollars worth of bonds on the open market, trying to lower long-term interest rates, pump money into the financial system, and the hope is that drives up stock prices, people feel wealthier, they spend more money, that it has all these desirable benefits. And it clearly has helped. I think there's pretty good evidence that all these policies have helped encourage growth. But the problem is the benefits tend to accrue most directly to the wealthy. So it's great if you have a big 401k, a big stock portfolio, that the stock market is up 100-something% since 2009. But that doesn't help you that much if you're if you're just trying to work and barely earn a living and don't have a bunch of savings in the stock market. So part of the problem is that because growth has been driven by this activism in the central banks, it hasn't spread as broadly as you'd like to see.
You had an interesting article recently about how income inequality, and we have growing income inequality, is really bad for the overall economy. Flesh that out for us.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a rethinking of some fundamental principles over the last couple of decades, partly just because of what the world has experienced. And, you know, the traditional view is if there's income inequality, if some of the highest returns go to the highest paid workers in society, well, that's the price you pay for the efficiency you get. That encourages the highest performers in the economy to work harder, and that makes a more efficient, larger economic pie overall. Now I think more people are starting to wrestle with the opposite possibility, which is that when so much of the national income, so much of wealth is going toward the very wealthiest in society, they're more likely to save that money, to park that money in banks, in the stock market, in investments, and not spend it on things that encourage further activity, whether it's building new factories or actually consuming. So there's a real possibility that this shift of more of the economic pie toward the very wealthy is resulting in lower growth than we might otherwise see and weaker standards of living for the middle class.
I noticed yesterday both President Obama and Vice President Biden were out in full campaign mode talking about labor for Labor Day, obviously, talking about the minimum wage. I guess trying to rev up the base for the Democratic Party on these particular issues?
Yeah, but I think the broader issue is something that resonates with a lot of people, which is, again, we've had 5 years of economic recovery. The president's been very eager to tout the jobs numbers every time they come in better than expected. But recognizing that that's not enough, and you need to see not just job gains, but wage gains. You need to see a real mass improvement in standards of living for Americans all over the country. And as long as you don't have that, people are still not going to be really thrilled with how this economy is doing.
Some fast food workers will be going out on strike, or at least lobbying for $15 an hour later this week. Do you think that's a message that resonates with people or even with economists?
Well, the interesting tension there is there is a risk if you try and push the minimum wage too high or wages for fast food workers like that too high, then it creates more incentives to replace human workers with machines. So you could imagine a McDonald's of the future where the hamburgers are grilled by robots and the fries are all automated, and you instead of a cashier, you press a button and your hamburger is brought to you. If wages go too far above their level that kind of the economic fundamentals support, you're essentially encouraging entrepreneurs and business people to find more ways to replace humans with machines. So it's not that this is a free lunch. You can't just say, well, you know, everybody should make $1 million a year. Ultimately, reality will prevail. The question is there room for fast food workers, as you in the example you mentioned, to make somewhat more than they do now in ways that don't radically change the economics of the fast food industry, but do result in higher standards of living for people who work in very difficult, jobs that aren't a lot of fun.
Do you think there is room?
I think there is. I mean, it's, you know, there's been, if you look at the chart of what wages and incomes are relative to GDP, it's been falling for about 40 years straight. And there's no inherent reason that should be the case. There's no reason that there's some magic number that of what percentage of GDP should show up in wages and salaries for workers. There's no reason that can't revert somewhat, and we might have a stronger economy where people feel better and have higher incomes as a result. And one way to go about that is through this kind of union activism you're seeing on fast food.
I'm going to be talking more with two guests who are waiting in the wings, but do you think that the U.S. economy has been permanently transformed as a result of the recession?
You know, this is one of the big debates in economics, and, you know, it's a cop-out to say it's too soon to tell, but I think there are a few things we do know about what's fundamentally changed. And I think one is a realization that going through this cycle of bubbles like we did in 2000 with the dot-com bubble and then the housing bubble that peaked in 2006, that's not a healthy way to go. And if we do get a recovery that's only driven by a run-up in stock prices or housing prices or other things in the kind of financial sector, that's not healthy, that's not sustainable. And so it gets back to this idea that what you want to see is a recovery driven by rises in wages, rises in employment levels for the nation as a whole, and that's what's disappointing about this recovery so far. That those are the indicators that have been lagging as opposed to financial indicators. You know, the stock market's hitting new highs every week, it seems like.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to see the same in kind of jobs and incomes.
Again, I'm going to be putting this question to our two guests, but I'd be curious about your response. Neil, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye, about the kind of gloomy attitude people have towards our political system and whether that feeds into the pessimism they have about the overall economy.
I think it does. And, you know, people, it's tough when Washington seems like it's a dysfunctional mess and they can't do anything, even on areas where a lot of people agree. So immigration reform, an area where a lot of Republicans, you know, there's room for compromise, but for some reason it just can't seem to happen because of the dynamics within especially the Republican Party. You know, will that change? Will another election cycle change that? You hope so, but you can see how there's a feedback loop where the economy feels bad, the political system becomes dysfunctional, and one encourages the other. That's not a great equilibrium to be in.
Any happy thing you want to end our conversation on?
You know, look, things are looking a little better. We just this morning, we got a new number on manufacturing in August, the strongest in some time. Construction spending number just this morning, good. There are some good signs in this economy. There are some signs that wages are starting to perk up. Let's hope it's not a one-time blip, that's part of a sustained recovery that we can be excited about.
Well, thanks for getting our conversation started. Neil Irwin, thanks so much.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And he's senior economics correspondent at the New York Times. The Upshot, and as I said, we have two guests waiting in the wings talking more about the U.S. economy. We'll take that short break, get back to our conversation, also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Alan Ayckbourn's Intimate Exchanges, starring Jennifer Childs and Anthony Lawton. A part of the 2014 Philadelphia Fringe Arts Festival, Intimate Exchanges features 8 possible outcomes and puts the audience in charge of the story. This award-winning comedy plays through September 21st at the Arcadia Stage at Arden Theater in Old City. Tickets and info at 1812productions.org.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. Director Adam Egoyan has been a critical favorite with films like Exotica and The Sweet Hereafter. He joins me to talk about his feature, The Captive, and what happens when critics turn their backs. That's coming up on Cue from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Resident Chef Kathy Gunst has suggestions for soup that transition from summer to winter.
You can make a batch of soup. You can have it cold for lunch, have picnics still on the still warm days. But those exact same soups are delicious heated up.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Although the economy has been expanding and unemployment has been declining over the last 5 years, Americans are pessimistic about their prospects and about the country's future. That's what a new survey from Rutgers University found, that a majority of Americans are more worried about the economy now than they were immediately following the recession. We want to talk about what's behind that worry and that malaise with Carl Van Horn, founding director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University and co-director of the Work Trends Project that conducted this survey. And Carl Van Horn, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also with us is Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College and co-chair and director of public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. And Stephanie Kuntz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Carl, let me begin with you. I'm looking at the title of this new survey, Unhappy, Worried, and Pessimistic, Americans in the Aftermath of the Great Recession. What is driving this deep malaise about the U.S. economy?
Well, I think partly what Neil mentioned at the beginning of the show is the structural changes that have gone on in the economy basically have not been favorable to workers, certainly for the last 15 or 20 years. So even before the recession began, people were expressing anxiety, even when things were doing pretty well. And remember, we had a boom in the late 90s. We were measuring anxiety at that point. And then what happened was the Great Recession, the worst in 70 years, devastating to very many people, millions of people. And in our research found that 80% of Americans either lost a job or knew someone, a close friend or family member, who lost a job. So they were very traumatized by this. And then the climb out of this has been very gradual. So overall, it's been a lot of bad news for American workers over the last 20 years. Structural problems compounded by a recession that made everything worse for them.
And your questions were about things like family finance, about job satisfaction, about plans for retirement. So very specific questions about people's personal, I guess, personal economies.
Right. And also, in addition to that, we asked them whether they thought that working hard and playing by the rules basically enabled you to get ahead, and that's been declining. So in other words, a lot of people feel like they're working hard, they're working harder, they're doing everything they're supposed to do, and yet they're not getting ahead. As Neil pointed out, and as the data shows, people's wages are not increasing, and also their sense of permanence in the job market is declining. And they're right about that, because most of the layoffs that occurred during the last 10 years are permanent reductions in force, as opposed to the experience we had in previous decades where layoffs were short-term. People expected to come back to the job they had before. Now, most people don't, and that, again, breeds anxiety and worry that they're going to be the next person to get a pink slip.
Stephanie, let me turn to you. You had a piece, interesting piece in the New York Times over the summer. Over the past 40 years, you wrote, the geography of family life has been destabilized by two powerful forces. One is the striking progress towards equality between men and women. The other is the equally striking growth of socioeconomic inequality and insecurity. And those seem to be two powerful forces sort of in contradiction with each other.
Well, they interact in complicated ways, of course. I think there has been a lot of real good news in terms of Americans' acceptance of equality, gender equality, racial equality, sexual equality, the stunning increase in support for same-sex marriage. But it has stayed on that kind of libertarian level, and it's been accompanied by or undercut by, sometimes reinforced but in complicated ways by, these deteriorated economic situations, which I would trace back more than 20 years. I mean, the late 1990s boom was really the only significant period of increasing real wages and opportunities since the late 1970s. And so we've been doing a long-term shift in this country in terms of this rising inequality that your speakers have been talking about. And gradually, as you pointed out, this insecurity and pessimism is really paying off. And in some ways, it's undercutting our ability to move forward, because it has contributed to a mistrust of any government ability to help solve it.
What you both are saying, what you both seem to find from some of your work, is that people, they're worried, they're scared about the future. Do you agree with that, Stephanie?
Oh, absolutely. You know, people measure their place in the world and assess their future prospects and make their decisions on the basis of their trajectory. You know, people, the poverty today is much less, you know, extreme than it was in the 1960s or early 70s. But, you know, in that post-war period from 1947 to the mid-70s, people could see their wages rise every year. They could see their benefits increase. What we've seen over the past 30 years is falling real wages, except for that boom in the late 90s, the destruction of pensions. You know, back in the 1970s, half of Americans had defined pension plans. Now only 10% of retiring boomers can look forward to that.
And Carl,
so I think that in addition to the wages, it's the declining security that we have in this country. More job volatility, the chance of people experiencing a major loss of income that they can't cover out of savings, increased by a full third between 1985 and 2007, and that's even before the recession.
Carl, you want to speak to that?
Yes, I think that's right. And what we find is perhaps the most depressing number is people's sense of what will happen to their children and grandchildren, which at the recession we found that about 50% thought that the next generation would do better than theirs, and now it's down to only 16%. So in other words, after this 5 year, their faith in the future has really eroded. They don't think that their children are going to do better, they don't think their grandchildren are going to do better, and that is definitely very strong headwind for people to put into, especially when people have worked so hard, in many cases, to send their children to college. They see that they get to college, and many of them are getting jobs that pay below what they expected, and they can't even afford to pay off their debts.
Carl, I noticed in your survey that about a third of the country is feeling pretty good. They weren't hit so hard by the recession. Either their finances have recovered, or they actually weren't hit at all. Are these the same third people kind of across the board?
Right. What's interesting about it is when we look at the demographics, you know, the characteristics of those people, their education, their even in some cases their pre-recession income, they look pretty similar with each other. In other words, to many people, it looks like they've had a randomly negative experience. So in other words, if you were a person working hard, doing well in a big pharmaceutical company that was bought up by another and lost your job, whereas the person next door neighbor was working in a different pharmaceutical company that didn't get merged, you lost and he or she won. So in other words, it really is a situation where people, for example, among the long-term unemployed are just as likely to have a college degree or better than less than high school. So in other words, there's a lot of people in this boat that have suffered a great deal, but they're very, very diverse in their backgrounds and in their regions around the country.
And that's Carl Van Horn, founding director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University, co-director of the Work Trends Project, which just conducted a survey, released the survey titled Unhappy, Worried, and Pessimistic Americans in the Aftermath of the Great Recession. Also with us is Stephanie Kuhn. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She also serves as co-chair and director of public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. And we are talking about work and family, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stephanie, going back to you and even going back to this article that you had in the Times over the summer, it does appear, though, that looking across the board, that women with college educations seem to be doing better than others. Do I have that right?
Well, yes, and in general, men with college education are doing better than others. But what we've seen since about 2000 is that even for women, growth in real wages, which was very strong up until then, mostly because we started at such a low level and we had this, it was perfectly legal to discriminate against the wages. But even for women, this has begun to slacken. What we have is the increasing kind of randomness that Carl talked about, I think, is really important in people's morale. But the other thing is what Neil talked about earlier, the increasing inequality among all groups, increasing inequality among blacks, among women. The average high-earning woman now earns more than the average man. And that's not been true through most of history. But low-wage women are falling behind just as men are. they haven't fallen as dramatically because they didn't start from such a high base, but we're both in the same boat.
Carl, your study touches on this, but the kind of pessimism the public has about our political system, or perhaps even the president himself in their, I guess, inability to address some of the things that we've been talking about.
Right. I don't think that should come as any surprise, because when people's economic circumstances are poor, who are they going to blame? You know, they will look at the political system. It is dysfunctional, clearly. They haven't been able to reach agreements on major policies in the last several years. But even if they had been making policy decisions, that if they were singing Kumbaya together, I still think that people would have a negative attitude towards the political system, because when people's economic circumstances are poor, and for many people it is still very poor after the recession, they're going to look around and blame their political leaders and say, why haven't they helped us? Why haven't the situation improved? And the answer is, they don't know, but all they know is that they're not happy with it. And that's why they're not comfortable with either Republicans or Democrats. And when we ask them whether it would make a difference if Republicans took over full control of the Congress, basically most of them said it won't make any difference, it will make things worse.
Does that mean people won't vote, do you think?
Well, I think that does depress voter turnout, because when they don't think that people think things are going to make a difference, they say, why should I bother? And as opposed to being motivated to say, well, I got to change things, they don't really see much reason to participate. Of course, midterm elections always have low turnouts anyway. So I don't think there will be a very high turnout this time.
Let me get to Duane, who's, it looks like he's calling us from the New Jersey Turnpike. Hi, Duane. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Doing good. And I agree with what he just said. I don't vote because I can't see if any of the politicians are concerned about the working class.
And what makes you say that? What makes you say that?
Well, it's the way I look at it, the big part of the problem with the economy and the work class is if a company is showing a profit, the only ones that receive anything from that profit are the executives, the higher-ups in the company. I have worked for a construction company, and at the end of the year, if the company had did good and showed a profit, supervisors and up got bonuses. The ones that actually did the work, you were lucky if you got a thank you.
Well, Duane, first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and if you raise a really important question, I want to toss this to you, Stephanie, which is this sense that the system is either stacked against people or it just does not feel fair, the way Duane describes it.
Well, I think that's very true, and I think there's a lot of good reasons for that. Lots of changes in the way, in the deregulation of the economy have made it more possible for corporations to make short-term decisions, to do speculation, raiding, things that increase the profits of the top officers and top shareholders, but do absolutely nothing for the workers there, and in fact may often lead to their losing their jobs, at which point the stock of that company goes up, you know, in these perverse ways. The other thing that I think is a real problem for people, going back a little historically, is that we have this vicious cycle. There's been this drumbeat ever since we came out of the Great Depression in World War II and the 50s with a sense that government can do something. That's been undercut by a very conscious ideological campaign, and it's been certainly reinforced by the inability of people like to respond to the banking system by actually holding the bankers accountable for what they did. But it becomes this sort of vicious cycle where people say, well, if government isn't going to protect me, my grandmother used to say, get what you can it, and sit on the can. So people become much more concerned with themselves, much less concerned with the possibility that we might be able to invest in better jobs or changing the political system in ways that made it easier for working people to be represented.
I mean, that's a kind of a scarcity mindset, that there isn't enough to go around, so I've got to take care of mine.
And that nobody's going to help me.
So, Carl, I mean, if we're talking about really structural changes, and perhaps the 50s was an anomaly, but nonetheless structural changes in the economy, what do you think should be done to help middle-class people or and working-class people and working poor, I hate that phrase, to get them, you know, to help them, frankly?
Well, there's a number of things that should be done, but I would start with the fact that the only way in which people are going to take care of their own family situation and improve is to improve their education and training so that they can compete for the jobs that we talked about earlier. There are some good jobs available, but many people don't have the education and skills to take those jobs, and so upward mobility for most people is still going to be based on their education and training, especially in the kind of global economy we have where many of the low-skilled jobs have disappeared and are disappearing. But a lot of those higher-end jobs, there's still openings for them, and there's a mismatch between the skills people have and the jobs that are available. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to get those jobs, but if you look at it from a micro standpoint, a family standpoint, investing in your education, getting a degree, getting a post-secondary degree, is really the safest route to a middle-class income.
I mean, there are jobs, and apparently there are jobs that you need certain skills but pay pretty well. You may not need a BA to get it, but perhaps some technical training can get you in the door, Carl.
That's right. I mean, we know that for people that have some form of post-secondary education, they're likely to make several hundred thousand dollars or more in their lifetime than a person who doesn't have it. So even a little bit of post-secondary education is very helpful, but you have to complete. You can't just take a course and then drop out. So getting it, getting the degree, getting a certificate in an area where there is demand is something that's very valuable for people. So that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is, and this is a longer-term issue, which is to restructure the political system and the economic system in a way that's somewhat fairer to the average person. And, you know, that is a long time off, I think. I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon. Mm. But things sometimes have to get worse before they get better. And unfortunately, that may be the case. If we had a person running for President of the United States who began to articulate some of these and got elected, you could see a different situation. And what's happening in New York, for example, with Mayor de Blasio, who's pushing an agenda which is very different than Mayor Bloomberg, we'll have to see if that works over time, but that's a good experiment in a city like New York where perhaps some of these structural changes spurred on by government will really make a difference for people.
I mean, a bit of a laboratory there to see if that works or not?
Right, and one of the most important issues has to do with housing, you know, whether there's affordable housing for people. That's obviously a huge problem for New York. If you keep the way the housing prices are now, people are going to have to leave New York unless they're working in very high-end jobs, and that's not a good mixture for an economy. In other cities, we have different kinds of problems. But I think that things can change. We don't think about this as the next election. I don't think it's going to be in this midterm election, maybe not even the next presidential election. But over time, if things do not get better, if the economy doesn't improve for most people, I think it will bring about political change.
Well, we're talking about jobs and the economy with Carl Van Horn and with Stephanie Kuntz and with you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavior Therapy supports WHYY and offers a research-based and compassionate treatment approach for clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. More information about the Beck Institute and CBT at beckinstitute.org.
On the next Fresh Air, as many students return to school, we look at how teaching became America's most embattled profession. We talk with Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, a history that explains how teachers have been embattled by politicians, philanthropists, intellectuals, business leaders, and parents, as well as activists on the left and the right. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Frankenstein, cotton, rice, and corn.
This idea that it's been somehow a terrible disaster for farmers really is a myth, and it's one which needs to be addressed, I think, because it's actually a huge success story.
Genetic modification of foods is controversial nearly everywhere except among scientists. How one scientist found his way from critic to advocate of GMOs. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Pennsylvania Farmers Union. Family farmers working together to ensure the survival of a diversified food system by serving as a vital voice for family-scale agriculture. More information at pafarmersunion.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She serves as co-chair and director of public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. We are talking about work and work life and its effect on families. Also with us, Carl Van Horn, professor of public policy and founding director of the John J. Heldrich Center on Workforce Development at Rutgers University. And the center just released a study titled Unhappy, Worried, and Pessimistic Americans in the Aftermath of the Great Recession. And we want to know if that sounds like you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Stephanie from, looks like Chestnut Hill, to join us on Radio Times. Stephanie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Another thing that contributes to people being not being able to get out of poverty or just keep their heads above water in the middle class is that the behavior of the banks after the crash, you know, they upped everybody's APRs from, I had a 7.9% up to 19.9%. And so if you had any credit card debt, it just went through the roof. Also, just trying to refinance a home when you have a lot of equity, you have good credit, you know, it seems like they've raised the bar for an income in order to qualify for just paying a little less for your mortgage. It's maddening.
Well, Stephanie, let me take your comment and actually toss it back to you, Stephanie Kuntz, about, again, she talked about the banks and the fact that so few have sort of paid the price for causing the recession. How deep do you think that frustration is?
Well, I think it's very, very deep. And I think that what Carl said about the structural changes that are needed is really worth emphasizing, because I have a slight skepticism about getting more education. 20 of the fastest growing jobs in America today don't require a college degree, and most of them are low paid jobs. Mm-hmm. We also know what happens, as Carl pointed out, to people who go in, take on considerable student debt, and then drop out. They can be much worse off in the long run. Really, we ought to live in a society where somebody who does the hard work, picking up the garbage, the kind of work that I don't have to do because I am a professor, those are hard jobs that ought to be paid a living wage. So I think we do have to look to these longer-term structural changes of bringing the banks under control, bringing not allowing corporations to get tax breaks for investing in short-term profits rather than investing in jobs. And I think that even if somebody loses the election, if we have politicians who were prepared to lose an election or two in order to bring these ideas out and be consistent about them, instead of pandering to every little scare that is raised by the people who oppose these kind of changes, I think we might be better off, really. And in fact, you know, most Americans, when you give Americans a graph of the inequality in our society and you don't tell them where it is, they say, oh, I'd hate to live in that society. They do not like the way this is. And we ought to build on that.
Well, that's interesting, and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, Stephanie, but there have been surveys about the support for something like raising the minimum wage, and it seems to have majority support. So it's not like there isn't support there for some of these issues.
Yes, exactly. And somehow we've had a political climate that's degenerated into these sound bites where everybody is so interested in getting elected and so afraid of the power of money, and you have to say the idea that somehow money has free speech rights the way that you and I have free speech rights strikes me as very weird. But at any rate, all of that has intimidated politicians into the fact that they're not really prepared to stand up and talk mm-hmm. about the hard questions that we need to address to change this over the long run.
To to you, Carl, and then we'll get back to our callers. Neil Irwin talked about what he saw as a couple of bright spots, including manufacturing and construction. You generally think of those as relatively better paid jobs. Do you see some of that on the horizon?
Yes, I think manufacturing, construction, and the other field I would mention is healthcare, where in part because of federal policy, we're growing the healthcare industry because more people have healthcare insurance and will have healthcare insurance in the future. And those jobs are not all high paying, but of course many of them are. And there are other continuing technological innovations that are happening in the United States. Many companies that had outsourced their jobs to low paying areas of the world are beginning to bring some of those jobs back because they realize that there are not only instability in those many of those countries, but also problems of intellectual property theft. I won't name any names, but you could fill in the blank of some countries that might be doing that.
I think I know who you're talking about, but yes, go ahead.
There's a lot of concern that maybe some of those jobs should be in California or Philadelphia or a region or in New Jersey than in some Asian countries. So, I mean, I think there's some bright spots, but I think that, the broader problem has to do with some of these issues that we've been talking about. We have an infrastructure which is deteriorating all over the United States, and yet the Congress can't agree to do that, to spend money on what is essentially a foundational investment that any economy has. We have some agreement, really, in some ways on the left and the right, about the problems with so-called crony capitalism, where we're just taking care of particular companies, giving them tax breaks, but not really growing the overall structure of the economy. In some ways, some Tea Party economic populists agree with people from the Occupy Wall Street movement. They don't realize it, but they really do. So there are the echoes, if you will, out there of change, as I said before, but they certainly, right now, people are in a funk because what they see is the president and the Congress fighting with each other, and if the president proposes something, no matter how good the idea might be, the Republicans are going to be against it and vice versa. So this is not a particularly good atmosphere for change. Midterm elections never are.
Stephanie, let me ask you a bit about some of the changes even within families, and it seems there are more single-parent families. Certain segments of the population, for instance, are not getting married. How do you think that affects the overall or even people's personal economies?
Well, I think that people don't want to sign up for long-term commitments personally if they don't feel that they've got long-term commitments in their society and their economics. And we're seeing a huge class divide between marriage rates and out-of-wedlock birth rates between the higher educated, more secure couples and the lower educated ones, and the ones with less income. And as you get the destruction of the traditional working class that really used to be the backbone of what both left and right agree are kind of family values, you see their faith in the future erodes. I had a group of students who were this last spring who were many very low income, and they just put it so poignantly. Three of them had kids. One of them was pregnant. She said, I've been to college, but my whole life I know that I could get fired, I could get bankrupt, I could just lose everything at any time. And so when I got pregnant, it felt like I couldn't turn this down. Whereas the more affluent students in my class were like, well, no, you would use contraception or you'd even get an abortion. You defer gratification. But people won't defer gratification if they don't think it's going to come along someday. And that's what happens to people's mindset with this kind of widening inequality and poverty.
Wow, it's a powerful story. Let me get Warren from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Warren. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
So we're having a great conversation, but it's at a very high level, it seems to me. And I was wondering if your guest speakers would have any advice for someone like myself. I'm in sales. I work in manufacturing and food manufacturing. My wife's a teacher. We make fairly good income, but we live in Chester County, mm-hmm. one of the most expensive counties in Pennsylvania, where the median house price is perhaps five times as much as the median house prices in other areas. And we make more than the median income, but we can't afford to live. I can't afford to pay for my child's education someday.
Well, and you're speaking, I think, for a lot of people, Warren. Let me see what Carl Van Horn has to say. Carl?
Well, I understand the concern, and it's something I don't want to be flippant because, you know, obviously you personally have to figure out how you manage that, and that's always a difficult thing. And that's really what our surveys show, which is that people are really struggling to figure out how to pay for increasing costs when their wages are not going up or their salaries are not going up to keep track with that. And that's what we found, people deeply worried about being able to afford a college education, worried that they won't be able to retire when they want to. In fact, we found a huge number of people saying, more than half, that they expect they'll never be able to retire because of the fact that they can't earn enough money to keep things together. So there really isn't any short-term answer that would be satisfying. I mean, you can't move because obviously that's not good. And, you know, you're not going to make your employer give you more money. And it's difficult to change jobs right now in this current environment because most people are staying put. What we call the quit rate, which is the number of people who even voluntarily leave their jobs, is way down. And that's because people are very concerned. They want to hold on to what they have rather than look for greener pastures somewhere else. And that's the way most people get wage increases, is when they move to another job.
Oh, that's interesting. Stephanie, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, again, I would feel inadequate to give really personal advice on this, but one of the traps that we get into in America is because the educational system is so uneven, the schools are so uneven, unlike many European countries that require that all school districts have the same resources. Middle-class people often find themselves in this trap of buying homes that are actually more expensive than they can afford, or more expensive than they need because they're trying to get into a good school district. I totally understand that. We all want to look out for our kids. But on the other hand, it becomes a vicious cycle in exactly the way your caller is describing.
You mentioned Europe, and I don't know if you're prepared to have any comments about that, but this seems to be that Europe is experiencing its own version of what we've been talking about, Stephanie, which is, you know, worried about job growth and job security and, you know, some other, I guess, demographic issues.
Yes, they are. I mean, we do have a worldwide global crisis, and Carl, I'm sure, is much more of an expert on that than I. But the fact that there are better social safety nets and more sense of solidarity in many other countries means, I think, that there's not as much pessimism in some of them.
Hmm.
There are other reasons that there are real racial tensions with immigration and stuff. But I still think that it's extremely important for people to have a security blanket, so to speak. And then as that has been stripped away from us, it is much harder to figure out how you can work with other people, not just figure out what the hell you're going to do for yourself.
Carl, you want to add to that?
Yes, as you pointed out, Marty, the European economy is not doing very well. And in fact, there are parts of that economy have already sunk back into a second recession. But what they do have is obviously, as Stephanie pointed out, a greater safety net. So they have longer periods of unemployment insurance compensation. They have other methods to help people remain in the workforce instead of laying people off. They have much more heavily regulated private sector. None of these things in the short run, maybe even the long run, are likely to come to the United States. We have a very different labor market strategy here, which is we give employers great latitude to hire and fire as they see fit. And if you look at over time, our economy's done pretty well. But as we've been pointing out throughout this hour, that doesn't mean workers are doing well. The economy can be working very fine, but it doesn't necessarily work for individuals and families.
But, Carl, we're not going to return to the 1950s, are we? Doesn't look that way.
No, I don't think we're going to go back to the 1950s, nor could we if we even wanted to. And in many ways, the 1950s weren't all that great for everybody.
True.
But I think that we can, as I've said before, do things to improve the fundamentals of our economy, which is growing manufacturing, building up our infrastructure where it needs to be built up, and creating more upward mobility. Some states, for example, are already talking about and implementing policies for free post-secondary education, at least for the first 2 years. That's an old idea that's coming back in some places as we realize that we can't be competitive and families can't get ahead unless a larger number of people can get that advanced degree. So there will be changes that I think will help our economy be stronger, and I'm optimistic in the long run. I'm just not so optimistic in the short run. And obviously Americans right now are not optimistic at all.
Stephanie, we haven't really talked about the stresses, I guess, inside of families when there is so much economic insecurity and even pessimism. But I'm assuming that the families are feeling the stresses, and it's showing up in things like depression and other psychological conditions.
Well, yes, long-standing research that shows that what happens when a family is under economic stress. The worst is the chronic economic stress. We know that kids actually experience losses in IQ points if they're growing up in families that are under acute economic stress. We find that marital relations. Now, one piece of good news in all this is the last great economic crisis we had, when women had to join the workforce, when men experienced the kind of losses, led to a huge reaction against women, a real backlash against them. We're not seeing this time. We're seeing tremendous respect for the women who have stepped up and who are co-breadwinners or maybe even have become primary breadwinners. Nevertheless, this sort of thing takes a toll on family relations. When you're under economic stress, it's really hard to look at the good things that are happening in your life, you know, to reward the child who's behaving well, or to say thank you to the partner who has made your life easier. Mm-hmm. What you notice when you're under stress is the things they're doing that make your life harder. And so then you respond in ways that are explosive, much more explosive with your children. You know, you just blow up and say, stop doing that. You forget the economy of gratitude that helps keep a marriage going, a relationship going. And so this was very, very stressful for families.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye to both of you. And thank you both very much. Stephanie Kutz, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Carl Van Horn, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And we began with Neil Irwin from the New York Times. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.